Project AK-47 rescues these child soldiers from a life of violence and gives them dedicated care through adulthood. We love, clothe, feed, educate, and shelter them in a place of refuge. Others train them to kill. We train them to love. But so many are still waiting to be rescued. Armies falsify their ages. Governments deny their existence. No wonder the world doesn't know. Help us tell their story. Project AK-47 is your call, a call to arms. Your mission, a mission of hope. Your fight, a fight for justice. Join us.
So, like I said earlier, my family has about 120 years of history over in Asia, starting with my great-granddad. So for those of you that have Asian skin, I don't have the Asian skin, but I got an Asian heart and brain in me. I'm probably more Asia than Western by at least 75%, I would say. And, you know, I'm happy to be over here, but I really love being over in Asia. It's home to me. And so I'm not talking to you today without some kind of understanding of the culture and the kinds of issues that we deal with. I really do have a fairly decent grasp of the area, even though I'm consistently, you know, trying to be a learner. And, you know, I remember having a conversation with a missionary of 45 years who sat me down once and said, "Marcus, I don't care how much you think you know the culture." He said, "When you get to my age, you're still not going to know everything you think you should know about the culture. You're always going to be blind. You're always going to need help from other people." So I'm not stepping into it saying we've got it all figured out, but I do think that there's a lot of advantage I have just from my family's history and so on. I just wanted to run through and do a quick Old Testament, what I call the Old Testament drum roll on children at risk. I just want you to get some perspective of major players in the Bible and how this works from God's perspective. We have, you know, Joseph, who was, you know, trafficked at the age of 17, sold into slavery. You know, he cared for his people during a worldwide famine crisis, and he actually managed the riches of the greatest superpower of the time, you know, at the kind of the other side of his journey. But he started as a traffic, you know, young man. You have Moses, who was, you know, a foundling in a time of human genocide. They were supposed to throw babies in the Nile, you know, to kill them, and he was put in the Nile in a basket, you know the story. But he became one of the greatest leaders of history, and he rescued 1.5 million slaves. A lot of us don't always think of the story in those kinds of terms. But, you know, he was a great anti-trafficker, really. But he started as a child at risk. We have Esther as well, sex trafficking. Why did I put that up there? Well, you know, she was in the king's harem, which was actually, a lot of scholars would say, would be a glorified brothel. And you know, she ended up, again, saving her people, coming to a position of great prominence. You have Daniel, and I know I skipped David, I'll get back to him. You have Daniel, who was a victim of armed conflict, and a lot of scholars would say between the ages of 9 to 11 years old, when he and his friends were brought into Babylon, they say that they were probably castrated because of the job that they would have in a position of power, because the kings and, you know, the important officials of those days didn't want anybody to be able to usurp the throne. So they were castrated, and he was actually raised in the center of the New Age cult of his day. The witches and the warlocks were his teachers, but yet he was a bright and shining light, and probably was, you know, one of the greatest counselors to kings that we've ever seen. And then we have young David, who is very interesting to me. I talk about him as a child soldier. Now, you guys have all probably heard the story of David and Goliath, but when David went out to face Goliath, at the oldest, against biblical scholars would say he was probably 15 years old. He could have been as young as 11 or 12. And, you know, in my read of the story, when they sent David out to face Goliath, nobody at that point had been willing to face Goliath. For one reason, they all believed they were going to die. And so when they sent David out, they thought he was going to die too. Really, all they were trying to do is buy themselves another day, one more day for their army to survive. Now, God turned the whole situation around, and David is a very fascinating young man on several accounts to me. I've done a little bit of study on his life, and I'm not going to go into the details of it now just for lack of time, but I just encourage you to do a study on his life. I really believe that his mother was actually a concubine that... Because if you look, David's dad Jesse had two wives. He had half sisters, and just one real quick piece of evidence that you can look at to see that is that all of his half sisters' sons were his good friends and were his mighty men and commanders in his army, but none of his brothers ever are mentioned as commanders or close friends in his army. Now, why is that? So there's a lot of other case I could bring towards the table, but I just want you to understand that in that case, his mom was a concubine from the Ammonites, and the Ammonites, like Ruth, which was in his lineage, who was a Moabitess, those were people who were supposed to be out of the outer courts of Israel for up to 10 generations. But God chose a young man who would have been very ostracized in the society and brought him forth as a king of Israel. And of course, you know that he became one of the greatest kings, psalmist kings of Israel that ever lived. And so from very humble beginnings. And David is interesting to me too, because when he came back after killing Goliath, there was another young man who's probably about 20 at the time who noticed him, whose name was Jonathan. And Jonathan walked alongside David. And, you know, as far as we can tell from scripture, he's probably the closest friend that David had. But Jonathan made three covenants with this young man. And one of the covenants he made, the first one he made, was when he first saw David, and he gave him all his armor. He gave him basically the physical things that he had to allow David to go on in his calling with God. And the second covenant, which happens sometime later, is David and Jonathan. David's now working in the courts of King Saul. And David and Jonathan are having a discussion. David's saying, "Hey, buddy, your dad's trying to kill me." And Jonathan's like, "No way. You know, I know everything my dad does. And he doesn't hide anything great or small from me. There's no way my dad's trying to kill you." And David's like, "No, I'm telling you the truth. Your dad hates my guts. He really wants to put me out of here." And so they have this conversation. And Jonathan makes another covenant with David and says, "Listen, whatever you want, I'll give to you." And so David says, "I want the truth. Go find out if your dad's really trying to kill me or not." Well, Jonathan goes and tries to find out, and what happens is his dad tries to kill him, throws a spear at him. Second time in Jonathan's life, his dad tried to kill him. So he had to face the painful fact that his dad really didn't love him all that much on behalf of David, so that he could walk with David. And so the second covenant he made had an emotional cost. The first one had a physical cost. The second one had an emotional cost. The third covenant he makes is some years later, and he finds David. Jonathan and David are together on this little wooded hill. And in David's words, Saul was chasing David around like a flea on a dog, trying to kill him. And Jonathan says, at this point, he says to his friend, he says, "Listen, you will be king, and I will be second to you." Now, and they covenanted again, it says, the scripture says they covenanted again at this time. I love that scripture because, see, Jonathan rightfully was king. That was his inheritance. That was his spiritual right, you know, God-given right to be king. But he didn't have a problem to say, "You know what? you're the guy. I'm gonna put you up there, and I'm gonna step down, and I'll be second to you. And if we would just take those three little principles right there, of, you know, first thing, how can I touch you on a physical level? What do I have that's mine, that's my trade, my skills that I can sow into your life? Secondly, what do I have that's gonna hurt me, that's gonna cost me to engage on an emotional level? And third, what do I have on a spiritual level, my inheritance, that I'm gonna say, you know what? What you're called to in God is more important than what I'm called to in God. And that's just a short sermonette for you guys, but it works on children at risk in general. But if you want to walk with child soldiers, I would just recommend, you know, store those three points away in your head and meditate on them. They're awesome covenants. And, you know, if we're what we were hearing about last night, a J generation or a Jonathan generation, if you want to be that kind of a people, it really will take the kinds of covenants of actually being willing to lay your life down. You can't do this kind of work without some kind of cost involved like that. I believe, you know, it's some of the greatest choices we can make as a people. So let's try to whip through here real quick because I'm going to run out of time. Child soldier. They're modern day slaves. They're owned by governments. They're forced into labor, forced many times, especially young women, but young men as well, into sexual exploitation. Typically in the areas we're working in, the kids will be between 3 to 15 years of age that we're targeting. Why as young as 3? Because a lot of these areas, they're actually orphans, and so they become property of the state, and they're moved right into army barracks, trained as just, you know, little gophers in the army, and then when they come to age like 8, 9, 10 years old, they start training them with guns and using them in the military. One of the things about Asia, which is the area we focused on, mostly, again, because of my history and so on, is like I mentioned earlier, Asia is a much more invisible place to work. It's much more difficult to see that the issues are really happening. But there are many, many child soldiers in Asia, not just Africa. You know, one of the difficulties you come into long-term with child soldiering is then that these kids are programmed to kill. So if you don't pull a child out of these kinds of situations when they're young, your country remains destabilized many, many years down the road because you have children that have been trained psychologically from the time they were knee-high to be killers. And so, you know, you have the aftermath of these problems that go on for decades afterwards. It's not just a simple, you know, let's go rescue these kids and the problem's over. You know, you really have to work with them through the process of having their hearts change as well. And if we leave it alone, it's not just a problem that these kids are children in the army for a decade. The problem is that they continue on in the army with the same kind of abuse that they receive themselves because that's all they've learned to do. And one of the really difficult things about working with child soldiers that's different than the other kinds of trafficking issues that you run into is that these children are protected by governments and guns. So like when you're dealing with, you know, the sex trade, you could have a government that's, you know, doing a cover-up and protecting these kinds of things. It's not uncommon, but you usually don't have the entire army backing you. You know, merchants the same way. If you're using, you know, children for physical labor or something, you know, it could be tied to the government. But in terms of rescuing a child soldier, you're going right to places where they have guns. You know, those military bases. So.